Okay, welcome to Lecture 5. And we're going to talk about CUDA memories. Okay, so in the past couple lectures, we talked about the CUDA threads, and we actually talked about the block versus, you know, the block organization versus the grid organization. And, you know, so we use a very simple matrix multiplication example and first show you the multiplication that uses only one block, right? And then we talk about how to introduce block ID into your code that you can start to use multiple blocks, right? And that gives you a lot bigger, you know, the ability to handle a lot bigger matrix and use a lot more threads. So, you know what, by this time you have a working code, and hopefully MP1, you're going to be able to, you know, just, you know what, go in there and do a good job and get a pretty good feeling about how to get a basic piece of CUDA program working. So what I'm going to do today is to begin to introduce to you some more specialized memory for performance reasons. And you really, theoretically, what you really need is just the global memory and some of these auto variables that are mapped into registers. But I'm also going to introduce mostly that shared memory today. And you know what? And circle back into the code and show you why it is important, and you know what, how that that's related to some of the historical account of how these GPUs work in the past. So you know what? If you look at the CUDA memory, you know what? It's not just a single memory space per se. There are actually several logical memory entities or several logical memory spaces in a CUDA architecture. So the first one is fairly simple. We already have seen this. You know, there is a register file, and these register files accommodate the variables that are declared as auto variables within the kernels or the device functions. And these variables are per thread. So if you declare a auto variable in the kernel, okay, such as that accumulator that we saw for the matrix multiplication, that variable is going to be replicated for every thread. Okay, for every thread in the kernel execution. And every one of them will be occupying a separate register, and that variable can be read or written, okay, by the thread. It's a highly efficient access. You know, every access is literally just, you know what, effectively immediate, but it's just a very small number of cycles. And because of the way the architecture works and all the multi-threading going on, the access to these registers is effectively instantaneous as far as each thread is concerned. Okay. Then you have a read-write per-thread local memory. This local memory is a little bit misleading. Local memory actually means a very large memory space available to each thread. Okay. It's local in the sense that the memory space is available on a thread-by-thread basis. So if you declare a variable in the local memory, that variable is also going to be replicated for every thread. Okay? It's not local in the sense of access speed. The access to the local memory variables are very slow. In fact, they reside in the same DRAM, the global, the device DRAM, the same DRAM as the global memory, okay? So the only reason why it's called local is because these variables are automatically replicated for each thread, and you can just, you know, you can assume that these variables are localized to the particular thread that you'll be looking at. And then read-write per block, you can declare a variable as shared, and that will put the variable into the shared memory space. The shared memory is quite small. Okay, it's only on the order of about 16K, but it actually is not fixed in the architecture. The architecture does not necessarily specify the size of the shared memory, and the size of the shared memory may well change from generation to generation. But you know, nominally, you can assume that you know it's on the order of about you know somewhere around 16K or so for each thread and for each thread block, and all the threads in a thread block will be able to see the same shared memory variable. That's why it's called shared. Okay, it's shared across all the threads in a thread block. And this is one of the reasons why you might want to maximize the number of threads in a block, because that will maximize the number of threads that can actually efficiently share the access of variable. They can efficiently exchange information, and also, as we will see today, they can efficiently share the bandwidth. You know what? This is an effective mechanism for them to cooperatively load some variables from the global memory, put them into that shared memory, and then everyone just enjoyed the very high bandwidth, low latency access out of the shared memory. Okay, so then we have the read-write per grid global memory. So this is the familiar global memory that we have been talking about, you know, we have already talked about, and you know if you allocate memory from the host. Right, we had this CUDA malloc, and the default is that the malloc is going to give you that a piece of memory in the global memory space, and then we have a read-only per grid constant memory, and we have not talked about this memory yet. This constant memory is also somewhat small. It at this point is 64K byte. And this is really meant to contain the constants or some kind of table lookup, constants for that can be used by all the threads and all the blocks. Okay. So if you have a piece of data that is going to be looked up, okay, by all the threads in your program, and this might be a very efficient way of using, you know, of accommodating those variables. However, if you put something into constant memory, you will not be able to write into these variables from the kernels, okay? And the CPUs can write into the, you know, the CPU can write into the constant memory, but the kernel cannot. And I'm going to come back and tell you why, you know what, there's some of these constraints. And I think we're going to also add a little bit more lecture material about the efficient use of constant memory. And this will be addition to you know some of the previous lectures of semesters. So how do you use these memories? You know what, the way to use these memories is actually quite easy. You know what, it's not a huge amount of work to be able to designate your variables into each of these memory spaces, okay? Physically, it's a fairly simple, a matter of very simple use of keywords. So this is one of the primary reasons why NVIDIA extended C with these additional keywords. This is a mechanism for you to be able to take some of your variables and designate them into the particular memory that you want. Okay. So you know what? If we want to declare a variable, let's say int local var into the local, you know, per thread. Remember that large per thread local memory. You would just add underscore underscore device underscore underscore followed by underscore underscore local underscore underscore. So you add those keywords in front of that variable declaration. And once you added this into in front of the declaration, the variable now is going to reside in that local. In the local memory space. And remember, this variable will be replicated thousands of times, okay? Because it's a per thread. So if you have thousands of threads, you're gonna be generating thousands of those variables, okay? The lifetime is also thread, meaning that as soon as the thread gets invoked, that variable is going to be created replicated. And then as soon as the thread finishes, the variable cease to exist. And you cannot assume that variable will be able to use that variable anywhere else. Okay, so once the thread completes, the variable disappears. You can designate a variable into the shared memory by using a similar style declaration device. Call it underscore underscore device underscore underscore and then underscore underscore shared underscore underscore. And this would put the variable into that high speed shared memory. Okay? And remember, if you have a kernel that declares a shared memory variable, what that means is only one copy of that variable, one instance of that variable will be created for an entire block. So all the threads in that block will actually see exactly the same shared variable. Okay? So every time you create, every time a block gets assigned into the streaming multiprocessor, that's when the shared variable gets created. Okay, and you need to reinitialize it and then use it and so on. And as soon as the block completes, that variable goes away. Okay, same thing. And if you just declare a add underscore underscore device underscore underscore in front of a variable, then that variable becomes a global memory variable. And this variable will be created only once, okay? Only once for the entire kernel invocation, because that variable is going to be visible throughout the entire kernel invocation by all the threads. It resides in that device DRAM. And so its lifetime is going to be the entire application, meaning that even across kernel invocations, you will be able to still see the contents. And I'm going to show you where these variable declarations need to be relative to kernel boundaries, because that's the other side of the question. Yes,
Albert. Just using scaling, at what point is it advantageous to use some local memory versus an automatic variable? Is it just to reduce register pressure?
Great question. So, this is actually just the next bullet, and I would go right into that. Okay. So, in order to use constant memory, the device, you can just use underscore underscore device underscore underscore and followed by a constant destination. So, this essentially declares a variable into the constant memory, and you can probably expect, and in fact you will be right, that having two keywords for the local, shared, and constant is kind of redundant, because the local, shared, and constant are essentially just device memory components. They're not on the CPUs. So if you just have local, shared, and constant and omit device, it will work correctly. Okay, the compiler will be able to realize that, oh, you really mean the device constant, device shared, and device local memory. So this is really optional. The only place that you really need to have underscore underscore device underscore underscore for a variable is when you declare a global memory variable. Yes?
So all, I guess, three of them except for constant are rewritable, right?
Yes, they are all, you can all rewrite into all these. Ah, okay. The question is, how do you avoid race conditions? Very easy. Always make sure that you use barrier synchronization properly. Okay. As with any other parallel programming, if your read-write is not properly synchronized, you will have race conditions, you will have unpredicted execution results. And I'm going to actually have several places I'm going to come back to that point. Okay, so this goes, then we're going into what Albert was asking a little earlier. You will have, the automatic variables without any kind of qualifier will go into a register. So if you have a variable that you want to, you want to create on a per thread basis, now you can just declare it as an automatic variable and then it will automatically go into the register, or you can call it a local, and they will be forced into that local space. Logically, they will work the same way, okay? Performance-wise, there's about a 300 times difference, okay, between the two. So it turns out that in practice, nobody really uses local variables for scalars, because the register allocator is actually quite good at this point. So you know what? Most likely, people just declare the local variables, the automatic variables, and if they declare too many of them, they will be overflowed into or spilled right into the local space. However, if you don't want to trust the compiler to do this for you, that is, your certain variables that you know are much more critical than others, then you could do this yourself and make sure that you only place the number of variables that can be accommodated by the registers into automatic declaration, and then you force these others into the bigger space by declaring local, so that you never have to rely on the compiler to do this. People sometimes do that, but there's a disadvantage of this, because from generation to generation, they oftentimes will try to increase the number of registers. So if you hand designate some of these automatic variables into local space, when you go from one generation to the next generation, you will not be able to take advantage of the additional registers. Okay. So unless you know for sure that you can do much better than the compiler, this is something that you should probably avoid. And oftentimes, people would define their algorithms or define their tiles and so on in a way that they will not exceed the number of register usage. But oftentimes, they will forget in the next generation, there are also more registers that they need to make some adjustment. That's one of the reasons why several research groups have been proposing to use more automated approach to define the size of these blocks and the size of these tiles, so that when you go from one generation to the next generation, you can mechanically migrate and mechanically use more registers by adjusting these parameters, rather than having the programmers to always try to remember that, oh, I'm going to the next generation, I need to increase the number of registers and so on. Arrays are more tricky. If you have an array that is declared as automatic variable, that array will be automatically shoved into the local memory. So if you have an array that you really want to have fast access, you need to explicitly load that array into the shared memory, and and using what we call the tiled algorithms. And that's actually going to part of the focus of the rest of the lecture. Any question before we move on? Anything like this? So let's go into the let's go into the aspect of where you declare these variables. And in general, when you try to decide where to place a declaration, from C's point of view, you already have some rules, right? If you have a variable that is only relevant to a function in C, in general, you would just place the variable declaration inside the function body, right? And if you want to have the variable visible to all the functions in a file, but not in other files, then you declare that static variable, right? But that's also outside the functions. And if you have a variable that you really want to make visible to all the functions, you would declare them outside the function bodies, and then essentially not declare as static, right? So they will become global variables, right? So in CUDA, there's a very similar additional consideration. That is, do you want the host to be able to see the variable, okay? And do you not want to have the host be able to see? If the host need to be able to access that variable, then you would want to declare that into global or constant space. And they will have to reside outside any function in your code. So you will not be able to place these variables into the declaration, into the kernel. But if the host really does not need to, you know, to access it, then you can, you know, you can have, you know, a register, you can have shared, you can have local, and these things can all be declared within the kernel. In some cases, you can also declare these variables inside the device function, okay? And if in the current generation, if you have a device function that will be called by a kernel, that device function will eventually be inline, okay? It will take the function and actually stick the code into the kernel code. So it would eventually generate a fairly big kernel by taking all the function, you know, all the device function that the kernel calls, and then just get move all the code into that kernel. So in many ways, when you declare these variables, you know, it almost doesn't matter if you're declaring the variable in the device function or in the kernel. Eventually, they will all end up in the same place. Okay, and if you have a variable that you truly want to have, you know, all the threads to, you know, to all the threads to access, and also you want to have them last across kernels, you also want to make sure that they're in the global memory, okay? And the mechanism, as I said, is not that difficult. But the difficult part is actually, you know, thinking through the access patterns of, you know, what that you're going to have for your variable, making that decision. Once you decided where they need to go, the destination is not all that bad. Any question? Yes, Wally.
How much difference in speed for accessing shared and local variables?
Shared variable is about maybe like 100 times faster than the local variables.
Faster?
Yeah, faster. But the shared memory is slightly slower than the register variables. Okay. Yes? The speed, the question is, what's the speed difference between the global memory and constant memory? The answer is there are two parts of it. The first part is they're the same speed in terms of the raw access time. Okay, so because they reside in the same, you know, DRAM, but constant memories are cached. So whenever your access pattern allows efficient caching, then constant memory can be several hundred times faster. Okay, and there are access patterns. We're going to actually come back to some of these patterns that, you know, you will need to, you know, to try to, you need to strive for in order to get constant memory to be very effective. Yes.
Is the reason why the developers did not choose to do hardware caching or shared memory?
Yeah. So the question is, you know, why didn't the developers do, you know, why didn't NVIDIA, you know, choose to do, you know, hardware caching and use the explicit shared memory? You know, this is one of the things that, you know, you may want to ask David Kirk again, because, you know, I really cannot represent NVIDIA designers, but I can tell you what I understood. So you have to understand that, you know, the CUDA architecture is kind of a byproduct of graphics processors. So, you know, if you come from the graphics domain, what happens is, you know, in fact, none of the previous graphics applications really needed to share data across threads. The only kind of data they needed to share are the texture or the, you know, or some of these, you know, constants that they may need to look up, right? And then they just reuse these constants across all these, you know, shader threads, right? So remember, the graphics world is all about painting colors, right, onto these pixels. So all those threads, you know, are essentially, you know, accessing some kind of predefined texture, some kind of predefined palettes and predefined something, right? And then paint some color onto the picture. So there's not really a, you know, a strong need to have read and write access, right, to some kind of shared data. So, you know what, now when they come into the compute domain, you know, you start to have a lot of algorithms that would, you know, have that kind of need. But remember, graphics business, especially when they design G80, graphics business is 99% or 99.99% of their market. So when they add this capability into the processor, you know, remember, every silicon area counts. So when you do the cache coherence, you know, if you start to implement the hardware caching, then you start to have all kinds of design issues, right? First of all, you need to have tag stores and so on, right? So that's additional cost. So that's definitely more expensive. And also you need to start to, you know, to have some kind of semantics about, when can I replace the cache contents? When can I throw away the cache contents and so on from the hardware point of view? So that adds to a lot of the verification cost. And all these things are going to feed into a 0.00001% of their market, right? So that's where the historical, I think that's how the historical decisions come about. Moving forward, you know, a few generations from now, who knows? Okay. So this is all good. Now, so you know what, you can use pointers in CUDA. So you know what, in this sense, CUDA is really C, and you can actually, you know, use pointers to, you know what, to simplify some of your programming. And you know what, this is also the difference between CUDA and a lot of the previous GPGPU, you know, generations. In the previous generations, you cannot use pointers, okay, to access your device variables. And that really restricts some of the programming, you know, algorithm designs that, you know, that people have. So this, you know, availability of pointers is actually a fairly nice feature, but on the other hand, it's also a feature that can easily shoot your foot. You know what, you can use to shoot your foot if you're not careful about it. So one of the things that NVIDIA decided to do was to only allow pointers to point to global memory. Okay, they do not allow use of pointers into the, let's say, shared memory. And so mostly these pointers are used in two ways. One is, remember the memory allocation, right? So the CPU host can actually allocate a chunk of memory in the global memory, right? And there is a pointer passed back to that, from the call, and then the CPU can call a kernel with that pointer. So this is not necessarily algorithm, you know, convenience, but it enables dynamic memory allocation and, you know, some more of these modern runtime features. So that's good. And the second one is you can actually obtain the address of a global variable, you know, inside the kernel by, you know, taking the address of a variable that is in the global memory space. And if you take the pointer, you need to be careful with these things, because you know once you start to do pointer arithmetic and you start to do all these, you know, nice things, you may start to, you know, to lose track of, you know, some of the memory access patterns, and that may actually make it very difficult for you to actually figure out how to organize your global memory accesses in terms of what we call the memory coalescing. And you know what, we're going to come back to this point, but you know what, so make sure that you use these pointers in a very, you know, on need basis and also in a very disciplined way, so that you yourself do not lose track of, you know, the way these pointers actually work. So, you know what, when we look at the CUDA programming, you know what, there's a really very common programming strategy that people use in order to get high performance, you know, out of their programs. And in particular, you will see that people will try to, you know, use the code, write the code into a way that essentially called tiled algorithms. So in general, what we do is you will have a large amount of data in the global memory. Okay, so when the CPU dumps a huge amount of data into the device, it will be dumped into the global memory. And then we would try to partition that huge amount of data into subsets. Okay, and each subset will hopefully fit into the shared memory. Okay, the smaller shared memory.
And then you handle each subset
with one thread block. Remember, all the threads in a block will have access to the same shared variables, shared memory variables, right?
So the idea is that you will load the subset from the global memory to shared memory. And essentially, you will use multiple threads to do it, okay? And so once you loaded these variables into the shared memory, then the shared memory start to behave like a cache, okay? And hopefully, multiple threads will be able to benefit from each data element that you loaded into the shared memory, okay? And then you will perform the computation, you know, that way. You will hopefully repeatedly use some of these, you know, some of these shared memory contents. And then in the end, after you're done, you copy the subset of your output out to the global memory. So, you know, the idea is through your computation, hopefully you will be mostly using shared memory, and you know, you'll be, you know, using very, very high you know, bandwidth and high latency accesses, and eventually you will, you know, flush it out to the global memory. And you know what, this is one of the reasons why the architecture is called streaming architecture, you know, in some of the literature, you know, in some of the literature, you know, terminology. Because what happens is, if you think about it from a big data structure point of view, you know, you will be kind of dividing the data structure into chunks, and then you will stream these chunks through the device. Okay, you will be essentially pumping these chunks, you know, into the GPU, and the GPU will crank on each chunk for a little while, and then take the next chunk, and take next chunk. And if you just stand in front of the GPU memory interface, you will see these chunks coming through, right? So that's why, you know, some of these people still call these architectures streaming architectures, okay? And I don't like that term because, you know, if you look at the streaming, it's really what I call the streaming mode of a CUDA processor, because, you know what, you don't have to have your program to stream that way. You could do random memory accesses to, you know what, and without these tiles. It's just that your performance is not going to be as good as, you know, as you would like. So every time you can kick on the streaming mode, you can get much higher throughput and much better performance from the hardware. So constant memory, you know what, you can actually, you know what, get some of the data into constant memory. And you know what, theoretically, the constant memory resides in exactly the same DRAM.
So, you know what,
the access time is actually very slow compared to the shared memory. It's, you know, it's essentially the same access time as global memory.
However, because the constant memory contains data that cannot be changed, it's actually very easy to do caching, okay? And because you don't need to figure out when you need to write a dirty data back, when you know how you can keep the consistency, you know what? So for read-only data, caching is a lot easier.
And then there's another, you know what, characteristic that you know what I'm going to introduce, but I'm going to come back to several times.
If you have a piece of data, a read-only data, that will be used by a large number of threads, okay? By a larger number of threads at the same time, exactly the same time, then constant memory is incredibly effective. And this is oftentimes the case if you think about it. You know, let's say if you look at the kernel code, you may have a numerical constant, let's say, you know, 37.822, right? A numerical constant. You write that constant into your kernel code, so that constant times x equals something, right? So you have a statement. And if you think about it from the GPU, you know, from the from the SPMD point of view, you will have thousands of threads executing this piece of code, right? And a lot of 32 of those are going to be the warps, and they will be all executing in the same manner, right? So every time they hit that constant, all the 32 threads are going to be using that constant at the same time. So that's why, you know, if you put that constant into the constant memory, you know what, you will be guaranteed to have 32 uses every time you bring the data into the constant memory. So whenever you have such a data, you will be guaranteed to have very effective use. And many of the convolution algorithms have exactly the same characteristic, even though they're not explicit constants. But because the data elements are actually being, every time you bring one of these data elements, the data element needs to contribute to the solution space of all the solution space points. And that actually is a very good way of using constants. And we're going to have a case study, looking at how these things work exactly. So you carefully divide your data according to your access patterns. If it's read-only, and many, many threads will use the data, use that data, at the same time, put it into constant memory. If it's too big, hopefully you can divide them into 64K chunks. And that's also another way, form of piling. And you have rewrite access, share within the block, you put it into shared memory. They're very fast. And if you read that write within each thread, try to put them into the registers. And if it's rewrite and you have input and output, relationship with the host, then you need to put it into global memory. We're not going to talk about texture memory here, and you're more than welcome to go to NVIDIA and look at their document, about texture memory. It's a very specialized memory. If you need to have very fast spatial interpolation, a table lookup for those things, texture memory can be really, really effective. But it's one of those components that are not very stable, and they get changed a little bit from generation to generation, and even break some of the programs. So that's why when we teach the first CUDA course, we decided not to teach texture memory. So some of you mentioned race conditions and so on, right? So I'm going to we talk about sync threads for sync threads for the barrier synchronization within blocks. But if you step back and ask, are there any particular, synchronized, somewhat synchronized memory accesses in this architecture for global memory? That is there any way for threads across different blocks to at least try to stay away from each other in terms of, destroying each other's results? There's, atomic operations on integers in the global memory. And let me explain this a little bit. Most of you from ECE or CS will know exactly, what I'm talking about. But I think it's beneficial that we bring everyone up to the same page. If you have ever had some kind of partner, based project in your let's say in one of the courses, so you and your partner may maybe collaborating and editing your final report. Okay, so let's say John and Ray are working together on your final report. So you have a file, right? You have a file that both of you can share. So after lunch, John comes back, and read the file. Then so it started to edit the file, right? And then 15 minutes later, Ray comes back. Okay. And he also started to loaded the file and then started to edit, right? So and in those 15 minutes, John was happily typing his changes, but he didn't save into the file, right? So when Ray comes back in 15 minutes, guess what happens when Ray bring up the file? It's the old contents, right? So, both John and Ray are happily editing their file, the same file, right? And, in an hour, John made 15,000 changes to the file, right? And right back into the file, right? So, hit the save and happily go out and play Frisbee, right? He's done with, all his work. And in another 15 minutes, Ray made three changes. Ray is a very deep thinker, right? So he thinks about this very deeply. He made three changes, right, to the file, right? And then, you know, he decided to, you know, to also save the file into the file, into the real copy. And then he goes to play Frisbee, right? So after both of them are done, when they come back, and they say, okay, you know, let's do a final read, okay? We're all done, you know, we should celebrate. And guess what happens when they bring up that file? Can someone tell me what they're going to see in that file? Are they going to see John's 15,000 changes? Because what happens is, remember, Ray brought in the file in the original form, right? Made three changes. And when John saved the file, the 15,000 changes did go into the file, fine. But when Ray saved his three changes, it's the original file plus the three changes that will overwrite John's version, right? So suddenly, we lost 15,000 changes from John, and Ray and John will never talk to each other again, right? So you know what? This is kind of a very bad situation, but many, many of us have experienced in real life, okay? We have, you know, we have had this kind of situation, all kinds of situations, and that's really what people call, you know, a form of what people call race condition, okay? This is the race condition between two rights. Depending on who writes last, you know, you will, the last one prevails, and then some of the changes get lost. So, you know, essentially, you know what, when you look at global memory accesses, you could have a situation where multiple threads might be writing into the same variable. And it's very, very common when people do something like histogram. You know, how many of you have computed histogram before? You know, it's a very easy concept, right? You look at the data that you have, and they say, you know, how many data are of this value range? How many data elements are of this value range? And there you have one variable that accumulates the occurrences of each data range, right? So that's why you have a lot of threads looking at those variables, right? And they will say, oh, thread one will say, I have a, you know, value 10 here. I want to increment the value range for that 10 by 1, right? And then the other thread also saw a 10 and it wants to add another one occurrence to the value 10. But if you have an unfortunate timing where both threads ended up fetching the original counter to their own space, right? And then add one, and both try to write back, only one of them will prevail, and you lost one of the occurrences. So that's why before they added these atomic operations, you know what, calculating histogram on the GPUs can be very, very painful, okay? And there are all kinds of, you know, interesting ways that people can, you know, try to rendezvous and then try to, you know, do the increment. So, you know, that's why very quickly after they released the first CUDA, you know what, they added the hardware support to, you know, to the, for atomic increment or atomic minimal, maximal, you know, finding, you know, taking the current value and then taking a new value and then write the maximal or minimal of the two back into the location. And so that it becomes atomic in the sense that one of the threads, let's go back to the original, you know, example where both threads are trying to increment the same, you know, histogram variable, right? So the hardware will enforce that as soon as one of the threads came and fetched the original value, the other thread will be forced to wait until the whole thing is over, okay? So the first thread will now add one to it, and you know the hardware will sense that, oh, the add sequence is done, and then the other will allow the other thread to go in and fetch whatever the first thread has written, and then add another one to it. So it's a forced serialization, okay? It does not necessarily guarantee any particular ordering, but it at least makes sure that the result does not accidentally miss one of the contributions, okay? And that's atomic operation. And any question about this? Yes?
So when you use the atomic operation, so the global memory block or something like that,
Yeah, so the question is, if you use atomic operation, the global memory will block a certain amount of time. Yes. So
the other
thread can rip all the part of global memory. No. OK, I see what you're asking. So the question is, if someone does an atomic operation on the global memory, will other threads be able to access global memory at all? That's actually implementation, you know, issue. So it depends on the granularity of their lock. Okay. So you know, my understanding is it does not block the entire global memory access. Okay. But the amount, the granularity of the of that locking is probably a implementation specific decision that they will not tell you. You can probably only, you know, see the effect by doing some testing. You can probably figure out by just doing some test code. Any addition that you want to add?
Not really.
Okay.
I would assume it's small, reasonably small granularity, but yeah. I don't know what it is.
Yes. And I don't think any of my friends at NVIDIA would like me to tell you either. So, okay. So let's put this all to work, right? All this concept sounds pretty good, right? So you know, let's put it to work, and then you know, make sure that we really understand how these things translate into real code, right? And you know what? So you know, there's a little bit story about this. You know, there's a joke that I always like. So you know, remember these local memory, global memory, you know, all these things. You know, it really only takes one keyword for you to designate these, you know, memory locations into their, you know, into the appropriate space. So the cost, the real cost, is for you to think through these things and make that decision. So the story goes like this. You know, there's a factory, and you know, they have a, you know, machine that you know, that a machine that you know what operates on the raw material and actually, you know, produce the raw prepare the raw material for the real manufacturing process. Machine is huge, and it's a, you know, it has a panel of, you know, about, you know, one panel of that wall on your side, and there, you know, something like 150 switches, you know, on the panel. So you know, it's kind of a, you know, so they have an engineer who was trained to maintain that machine. And the engineer, you know, keep the machine running by making sure that, you know, all the settings, and you know, those settings depend on the temperature, depending on, you know, all kinds of things, time of the day, and all that, right? So the, you know, there was, after 30 years of faithful service, the engineer retired. So after the engineer before his retirement, he wrote down some of the, you know, some of the rules and so on, and say, hey, get the younger generation engineer to, you know, to operate based on these rules. So they, you know, they were okay for a while. But then, you know, there was a day, you know, one day something happened and the machine stopped working. And then, you know, the young engineer tried all the rules and it just couldn't get it to work, right? So, you know, the manager got really panicked. You know, every day of downtime is like, you know, thousands of dollars or something, right? So he called the engineer back and then say, hey, you know what, can you come back and do a consulting job for us? You know, I'll pay for your time, right? And, you know, da 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 da. So the old engineer came back, you know what, kind of look at it, you know what, and you know what, kick it a little bit, listen a little bit, and then, you know, play around a little bit for about 5 minutes, right? And then he zoomed into one of the knobs, right? Turned it a little bit and zoomed to another knob, just turned half a, you know, half a turn or something. And then the machine, boom, started to work, right? So the manager was overjoyed and say, oh, you know what? I was so grateful. You know what? You know, send me the bill for your time. You know, we'll definitely pay it. And you know, he was thinking, you know, that the wage, you know, back then was like you know what, $2, you know, something like 50 cents an hour, right, for the worker. So you know, even if he charged me 10 more times of that, you know, it's great. You know, I got the machine working. So he got a bill for $1,000, right? And the manager got really, you know, upset and said, you know what? So he called the engineer and said, why did you charge me $1,000? You know, your old wage was like 50 cents an hour and you were there for less than 10 minutes, okay? And how can you do this to me? And the engineer says, yeah, you know what? You know, the breakdown is as follows. You know what? I actually only charge you 50 cents for the time that I actually spent to, you know, to turn the knobs. But the rest of it is 30 years of hard work
leading to the experience, the knowledge that I know which of the two knots to turn, right? So you know what, in many ways, you're going to see a very similar situation for your code, okay? You know, by the time you're done, oftentimes you're going to say, hey, you know, this code is not all that different from the code that I wrote before. And it's going to be very frustrating when you show your code to your advisor, okay? You know, your advisor is going to look at both pieces of code and say, okay, this code, you know, this code is supposed to be your beginning code. This code is going to be, you know, what you ended up with. And you know what? I only saw like four keywords of difference and maybe something slightly rearranged, right? And where have you been in the last 4 months? Okay, so tell me the truth, right? So you know what, you're going to see some of that here, okay? And a lot of that has to do with, you know, thinking through what you're supposed to do. That's the reason why we are emphasizing more and more of these, you know, pattern-based education, because you should have to reinvent some of these, you know, important patterns. You should be able to, you know, just learn from others so that you can cut down a large amount of time that you need to reinvent some of these things. So let's go back to the matrix multiplication kernel, okay? And you know what, let's pick up from the point where we're using multiple blocks, right? So you know what, the code does, you know, a couple, you know what, some simple things. It, you know, will identify the role. So for each thread, right? So this, remember, the kernel code is, you know, specifying the activity for each thread. So for any given thread, you will have the thread block ID and thread ID, right? And there, you're going to have both X and Y components, right? For those, you know, thread IDs and block IDs. So you can use the block ID and thread ID to identify the particular row and particular column of the P matrix that you're working on, right? So that's easy. So you know, when you do a simple calculation, I've already talked about that. And then within the inner product group, you would, you know what, you would use the row information to identify the MD input, right? The MD input row, and then you use that iterative variable K to walk through that row, right? You will also use the column to decide, you know, to pick the column of the ND array, and then use K to walk through that, right? So for every K value, you take a pick and you do the inner product multiply, and then you accumulate into the inner product. So that's a, you know, very straightforward approach. And you know what, you're going to be accessing, so you know what, global memory, right? You're going to be accessing global memory with MD and ND. And every thread is going to go to MD and ND for their elements, right? And if you remember, you know what, when we look at these threads, you know, for the output matrix P, you know what, all the elements in the same row of P will be accessing the same row of MD, right? But they will all go to the global memory and fetch those same elements individually. Okay, they will all repeat each other's accesses. So they're going to be, you know, all doing some redundant memory fetching work. Before we go into more details, let's do a little bit of calculation. Okay, so you know what, this is kind of a, you know what, just a very quick and dirty calculation to show you what that piece of code really means in terms of time. And this is kind of one of the, you know, the first experiences that you're going to have in terms of, you know, what makes parallel programming more difficult than, you know, traditional programming, okay? And you know what, in this particular case, you know what, it's in a, you know, it's the calculation of memory bandwidth consumption, okay? And you really need to be aware of memory bandwidth consumption because all these chips are inadequately designed as far as memory bandwidth is concerned. Whether it's CPU, whether it's GPU, they're all inadequately designed. The reason is very simple. Any additional speed that you can add into the memory access path costs money.
okay? And they also cost a lot of energy, a lot of power. So, you know what, this is one of the most constraining design, you know what, aspects in designing all these processor chips. So they already have put as much memory bandwidth as possible at that chip boundary. And you know, it's just very, very hard for them to, you know, to give you more memory bandwidth at reasonable cost. So let's calculate this a little bit. You know what, the way to look at it is that you say, hey, you know what, all the threads will access global memory for their input matrix elements. So you know what, if we go back to slide 10, you will see that, you know what, every thread will go through an inner loop with, you know what, with two memory access, global memory accesses per iteration, right, of that inner product loop. So every time you do the next k iteration, you end up going to the global memory two times. And for those two times, you will do one multiply and one add. So that's going to be the kind of the dominating computation pattern, right, for this piece of code. You're going to be doing two global memory accesses followed by two calculations. Two memory accesses, two calculations, right? Now, going back to slide 11, that means that every memory access is 4 bytes. It's a single precision floating point, okay? So we're accessing 8 bytes in each iteration, okay? We're taking 8 bytes of data from the global memory. And then we're doing two calculations, one is multiply, one is add. So essentially, we're doing 4 bytes of memory access for each floating point operation, right? Every 4 bytes, do a calculation. Every 4 bytes, do a calculation on average. And so flux is floating point per second, okay? Floating point operations per second. In order to reach one floating point per second, we will need to have 4 bytes per second, right? And we're not talking about a small number of floating point operations per second. We're talking about, for this chip, 346.5 gigaflops per second, okay? And that's the maximal calculation rate that someone can sustain if we can feed the chip with enough data, okay? So this chip is very, very hungry, okay? It can calculate 346 gigaflops, okay? You know what, giga is what? You know what, 10 to the ninth, right? So you know what, in order to appreciate that number, you know what, I actually had, you know, when my son was a little younger, you know, he was having trouble with some of these bigger numbers, right? So he would say something like, you know what, a million, is that a large number or a small number? You know, it seems like everyone on TV has more than $1 million, so maybe it's a small number, right? So I said, Brian, okay, let's do a little bit of exercise. We'll pick a Saturday, okay? And then I asked him to, you know, to write down numbers, right? So from 1 to 1 million, right? And you know what, so you know what I said, you know, it's a good exercise, you know what, by the end of the day, you will know exactly, you know, what a million means. So, you know, so starting in the morning, you know, he started very diligently, you know, and by noon, he was close to maybe 3,000 or something, okay? And then, so you know what, so I said, he said, Dad, can we take a break? I said, no, you're not even close. You know what? A million is 1,000 of 1,000, right? And you know what? You're only 3,000. You're only, you know what? Less than 1%. You still have 100 times more to go, right? And Brian said, okay, I'm convinced. It's a very big number. Okay. So, billion. You know what? If you're not convinced that, you know what, 346, you know what, gigaflops is a big number, I really encourage you to do the same exercise. Okay. And then, you know what, so you know what, so in order to sustain this 356.5 gigaflops, you really need to have 4 bytes per flop, right?
So you need to have four times of that in terms of bytes that you can feed into this processor in order for the piece of code that we just look at to be able to run this chip at its full potential. Make sense? Okay? And what that means is that you need to design the chip so that you can pump 1,386 gigabytes, okay, per second into that chip. Okay, if you can do this, you will be fine. And for those of you who think that this is only, you know, this is kind of the kind of calculation that you will only need for computer programming, you know what? Read the most recent Time article about the federal bank bayout, okay? And there's an article that did a very similar calculation about how much money the government really needs to pump into the banking system, okay, compared to what they actually did, right? And you will see a very similar calculation, okay? And this is the reason why I really believe that in the future, anyone who wants to make any kind of significant government decision have to have taken 498AL. We can avoid some of the very bad historical mistakes, okay? Because these guys didn't think numerically. They didn't really, you know, understand the magnitude of these things, right? So you know what? You know, for those of you who are really interested in becoming, let's say, the Secretary of Treasury, you know, Treasury or something, right? You know what? Make sure that you take an afternoon and write down 1,000, you know what, from 1 to 1386 to the 10 to the 9th, okay? And you know what, once you finish that exercise, that gives you the minimal qualification to become the Secretary of, you know, Treasury or something. Anyway, enough of the political statement. But there is an important thing here. The important thing is, you know, a lot of people say parallel programming, you know, is tedious and so on, right? But I think really what it is really parallel programming kind of, you know, expose some of the complexity of designing large systems, right? That many of us in the computer science or computer engineering area kind of conveniently disregarded. And now we're actually being pulled into this kind of complex system, and we're forced to begin to really think carefully about these things. And that's why it became so difficult. We're just becoming real, okay? Unfortunately. Now, so what do we really have? The NVIDIA guys actually worked really, really hard. They didn't give us 386 gigabytes per second memory bandwidth. They worked really hard to give us 86.4 gigabytes per second. You say, oh, that's not a whole lot. You know what, I need, you know, 1,300 of those, you gave me 86, right? And on the other hand, you know what, if you calculate, you know, another way of looking at this is, well, you know what, for 86.4 gigabytes per second, you know, remember, we need to consume 4 bytes per operation, right? If you divide that number by 4, that gives you the highest floating point rate that you can sustain. And that's what? 21.6 gigaflops. And you scratch your head and say, who in the right mind will build a chip that can actually do 346.5, you know what, gigaflops, but the memory bandwidth only can allow you to do 21.6 gigaflops? Well, the reason is these guys were counting on you, okay, to not write the piece of code that I just introduced to you, okay? And they were banking on the fact that you are much better than that, okay? You will be write a different piece of code to do the same thing, but you can sustain something closer to this, okay? Much, much more close. And that's where the shared memory and custom memory kind of stuff come in, okay? So the idea, you know, this goes back to that tiled, you know, approach. So the idea is to use the shared memory to reuse global memory data. So, you know, if you have a, you know, let's say, if you have a, you know, you and your office mate, you know, you both like to drink coffee, right? And you know, so your advisor kind of, you know, was wondering why the two of you have not done a lot of work lately. So the advisor kind of, you know, kept the door open and kind of, you know, watch what's going on at the office door. And he noticed one thing. He noticed that you go out to fetch coffee, you know, every 15 minutes, okay? And then, you know, every time you go to the coffee area, you know, you see a bunch of, you know, very happy grad students, and you know, so you were talking, and you know, so, and then 15 minutes later, you come back with, you know, a cup of coffee, and then your office mate, you know, take his turn, and then you know, go to the fetch coffee, and then you know, talk for a little while, and then 15 minutes later, came back, and the advisor calculated and say, huh, they work for 15 minutes, they go socializing 15 minutes. So, you know, automatically you're half of your peak bandwidth, right? So, you know, not good, right? So, you know, so being a clever professor, the advisor says, now I'm gonna impose a new rule. I'm gonna say, you know, every time you go and fetch coffee, you know what, you have to, you know, have only one person carrying both mugs, right? So, you know, you guys need to drink coffee, you know, synchronously, okay? So, you know, every 15 minutes, you are allowed to, you know, the next 15 minutes, you know, you are allowed to carry two mugs. So you will, you know, get two mugs and then you will socialize for 15 minutes, right? And then next time, after you go back, in another 15 minutes, your office mate is allowed to go and grab both mugs, right? And then you calculate that efficiency, and suddenly the advisor was able to get some paper out. Because what happens is rather than 15 minutes, you know, work time, 15 minutes idle time for both of you, you will start to have 15 minutes of work time, and then you will go 15 minutes, but your office mate will be able to score the full 30 minutes, right? So one of you will be able to actually cut down one trip, right, for each fetch, right? And that's exactly how some of these tiling algorithms work. You make sure that every time you go and socialize, you satisfy the needs for multiple of your office mates, okay? So that your advisor can get the paper out, okay? And this, you know, make everyone happy, right? So, you know what, this is the way, you know the slide, whatever, I don't even remember which slide it is. You know what, the picture shows how this, you know, how the idea actually works. You say, you know, in order for me to produce the two elements in P, you know, that are, you know, one on top of each other, you know what, I really, that both of them really just need the same column from ND. So, you know what, if I can somehow fetch these ND elements into the shared memory, okay? So essentially, I would take both coffee mugs, right? And then fetch them back into the office. And then, you know, hand one to my office mate so that the calculation of these two points are going to be sharing that same long trip, right? Then I can cut down the amount of global memory accesses that I need to do in order to produce these two elements. If I can carry three mugs, I get even better. If I can put one more mug on my head, I get even better. And if you have seen some of these Chinese acrobats, they can do those, you know, spinning plays on their toes. So you can, you know, hop and with two more coffee mugs, you gradually increase the efficiency even more, right? And you know, one on the shoulder, one, you know, by the time you're done, you're a hero for the whole group. You know, you just, you know, you started to publish 1,000 papers a year, and you know, so you know, this is you know, pretty much the, you know, the trick, right? So what needs to be, but what happens is that you need to make sure that these office mates drink coffee in a synchronous way, right? You have these 15 minute windows that everyone needs to, you know, make sure that they drink up the coffee so that they can catch the next train, right? And then so the next person, right, do the fetch, right? So, you know what, that's kind of the price you pay. You need to make sure that everyone get somewhat synchronized in their activity so that they can all catch the same train. So the way to do this is to actually partition the data, the input data, into these tiles, so that when you calculate an element, when you calculate a P element, what you would actually do a segment on, you know, let's say if you look at the M part of the picture, you know what, instead of going all the way from beginning to end on that row, you would have the calculation of the element to go a small segment. And within this small segment, everyone else will also be doing that small segment, so that all their activities are confined, so that within a thread block, everyone will be doing this will be doing their individual small segment. And once they're done with all their small segments, then you go out and fetch the next block. And then all the threads in the thread block will be doing that additional small segment. These small segments allows the threads in the block to synchronize, okay, to actually, you know what, do their activities roughly at the same time, so that you can afford to put a small chunk of data into the shared memory, and being sure that all the threads will be able to use up all the elements that they need before you move on to the next tile. Does that make sense? So that's the idea, okay? So we are at 10 till, so you know what? We're going to come back to this slide next time, and just so that you have a sense, you know, what's going on, we're going to actually take you through a very small example to show you exactly what that, you know, the little segment means, and you know how that code gets reflected in the code, that you will have a complete implementation. Okay, this is actually historically one of the more difficult part, and so that's why after, you know, when we taught the summer school, David and I went through a little bit different approach. So you know, when you look at the old slides from last time, we actually had several students in the previous class that made some suggestions. So you know what, this is one of the improvements based on their contribution. Okay, so see you on Thursday.
Cluster account passwords here. Testing. Monday.
There's no reason why you cannot. If I don't do anything, then you will continue to be a
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, people could have gotten them along.